It's like all these things that we're doing that we never envisioned doing, they're just not sexy. It doesn't put us in a good mindset of having sex. And so the question is like, how can we kind of re-evoke some of that mystery and like sexiness in our relationship?
Hello, you're listening to The Rare Life. I'm your host, Madeline Cheney. I will tell you, we pride ourselves in tackling the tough and sensitive topics relating to disability parenting, and today is kind of the epitome of that. Today, just in time for Valentine's Day, we are discussing the topic of sex. Because, as we all know, our children's disabilities and medical complexities can affect every single bit of our lives, and intimacy with our partners is, unfortunately, no exception. For this one, we asked you, the community, ways your sex life has taken a hit and how you feel about it. And as always, I am so grateful for everyone's vulnerability in sharing. I'm also more than normal grateful to the lovely and wise Amanda Griffith Atkins, licensed therapist and disability parent, for joining me once again to tackle this topic. There is no way I would have felt comfortable covering this by myself. This episode is chock full of relatability and tips on how to improve intimacy between you and your partner, which I cannot wait to get to. But first, a huge thank you to this episode's sponsors: Kristen Hooker, Nina Jones, Nani Barron, Lori Long, Laura Lindquist, Jessica Pate, Colleen Lawrence, and Catherine Holloway. What do each of these generous people have in common? Well, me. My mom, several aunts, a mom of a childhood neighbor I always idolized, a church leader from my teen years, a colleague from the disability parenting sphere, and a friend. It was so incredible to ask for support of The Rare Life, both in a simple Facebook post and a few direct messages, and to receive this outpouring of love. Donations were made of all sizes, and each one meant the world. A few I talk to regularly, and a handful I haven't spoken to in years. I am so grateful for their support that makes this important episode possible for each of us in this tender and fierce community. Which also leads me to our big family and friends fundraiser kicking off next week. From February 15th to February 29th, which also happens to be Rare Disease Day, we invite you to join us in seeking support of The Rare Life from your family, friends, and childhood neighbors. Those who love us often feel a bit helpless in knowing how to support us in meaningful ways. This is a fantastic opportunity for them to show their love for you by helping this beautiful resource continue to give you the solidarity and therapy that you need. As many of you know, we are a nonprofit organization and rely exclusively on donations and giving in order to continue functioning. You can join us by doing what I did during our last fundraiser. Simple social media posts geared towards all of your followers, including old friends you haven't spoken to in years, you just never know, and individual personal messages to those closest to you. In those messages, we will encourage you to share what the podcast has meant to you, a little bit of your story, and how much it would mean for them to help support this resource. We're trying to make it as straightforward and easy as possible for you to join us in this fundraiser. For more details on how to go about participating, find us on Instagram at the_rare_life or on Facebook by searching The Rare Life Podcast, or on the website, therarelife.org. Thank you for your continued support of this beautiful organization and for listening today. All right, a little more about today's co-host, Amanda Griffith Atkins, and then we'll hop right into the episode. This is her 11th episode on The Rare Life. She owns a therapy clinic in the Chicago area and runs an incredible social media page. You can find her by searching her name, amanda.griffith.atkins. She has three boys, the oldest of which has a rare syndrome called Prader-Willi syndrome. Amanda is a lover of jogging and of her grandma's old journals. Let's jump in. Hey, Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Hello, we got a spicy one today.
Yes, we do. And as anyone who follows us on Instagram knows, this is a take two of this episode because we tried last week recording this topic and it was a flop within the first like 4 minutes. And I was like, my brain's not working. This is a really important topic. We're going to do it justice. We're going to do it again. So here's our take two. I'm both ready to go.
Yeah, and we're both way more organized this week. So just a good reminder that sometimes the answer is no. And that's where we were last week. So we're honoring that and it'll be all the better because of it.
Yes, it's taken me so long to learn that. So today, obviously the topic is sexual intimacy within a partnership that includes a disabled child. And I think at the get-go, let's like acknowledge the fact that like we're talking about partners, not necessarily, you know, husbands and wives, since not everyone's like married or maybe in like different types of not like less traditional relationships. But like if we accidentally or like in the quotes and stuff, if it's like husband, wife, like obviously it applies all around the board and you can like switch out for what makes most sense to you. So we're including everyone. So I was thinking as I was like putting together these notes that it would probably be a really cool thing to have this episode be something that you listen to together with your partner, because I think it'd be a really great way to, I mean, a lot of times in these types of episodes, people are like, oh, yes, like they just expressed how I feel, but I never really knew how to put it into words. I didn't even realize I felt that way. And so I think that that could be a really cool way for you to pause it and be like, that is how I felt this whole time. And then for the, you know, your partner be like, oh my gosh, like that's crazy. I didn't realize that. Or just to have like your eyes open and that for that to go both ways. And then I think it would be really cool too, to just make some goals for yourselves too, by the end of like, hey, like here's where we are, here's where we want to be like in a year or, you know, in 6 months, and to kind of work towards that. And Amanda here is going to offer some really great tips of how to do that. So be listening for goals you want to make.
Also, I was thinking as you were talking, like, let's be honest, it is hard for a lot of couples to talk about sex and intimacy, especially when you're parenting a disabled child and maybe you're not having sex as frequently as you want. Maybe you're in what you would call a sexless marriage. And it is really hard to bring up this conversation if it's not something that you're frequently talking about. So maybe this gives you and your partner a good opportunity to sit down and open up the door a little bit. Use this podcast episode as a launching pad for you and your partner to discuss sex, because we know that that's can sometimes be a really hard topic to bring up.
Yeah. It's been interesting too, to hear from different listeners of like how different episodes of the podcast have been really therapeutic in nature. Like, oh, I go to therapy, but this one was like, this helped me understand the principle more than I have been able to in therapy, just because of the different type of mode it's in, you know, of just being able to sit and listen and hear what other people are saying about it that are in similar situations. So I am hopeful too that like, if you know you would benefit from couples therapy or like sex therapy in, you know, specifically, like hopefully this episode will, I don't know, be a little bit of like a dose of that, and maybe even be a little like just different. I don't know. For some people, it could be more effective just to like passively listen and kind of take it in. And again, like kind of figure out how you even feel about it if you're not sure. So,
Madeline, are disability parents having sex? That is my question.
That's a really good question. So we have a very small case study because I did on Instagram, you know, superficial. But from that, I think there was a good handful that did participate in the poll that I put on my stories. I think it was probably like 200 people. So like a decent amount as far as Instagram polls go. In that, we had the three options of like, what's your sexual life like in context of your disabled child, or like since they entered the picture? And we had the majority, right? So 70% said it's pretty mediocre. It could be worse, but it's not great. And it's definitely taken a hit. And I have like one like quote that represents this of a message someone sent. They said, "Quickies are all we get. I miss my husband so much just being his wife." That's kind of representative of like kind of this like, we still have sex, but it's not great. I miss the way it used to be. So that's the majority, which I thought was interesting. 20% said it's pretty much non-existent. Someone said it's basically dead. All the anxiety, burnout, resentment, and trauma killed it, which we're going to address all those things. That's kind of like our outline right there. And another person said, we haven't done it in years. So that's kind of that sexless marriage. So if you are someone in that group, you're not the only one. Like 20%, like, yes, that's not the majority, but that's a pretty big number, right? As far as like that population of it kind of just being gone. And then the remaining 10% said that their sex life has been unaffected. And then one person was saying, we make time for it as it's important to both of us. So that's kind of the way it shakes out. So 70% mediocre, 20% is pretty much gone, 10% is unaffected.
So a way that we can summarize that is that 90% of parents, their sex life has been impacted by disability parents.
Yeah.
That's pretty huge if you think about it.
Yeah,
that's a good point. There's varying degrees within that 90%, but 90% of disability parents feel that their sex life has been impacted by parenting. So if you're feeling that, then you're definitely not alone.
Definitely. I think that's a really great way to look at it. Let's jump in. I gathered tons of answers from the community, which I think was so great. People were willing to share this because it's, you know, really personal stuff. I de-identified all of it. I have no idea who said what. And obviously no one here will know who said what unless you're listening. You're like, oh, that was me. But we're going to go through like all the different ways that having a child with a disability has impacted our sexual life for the worse. And Amanda here will have lots of great tips and tricks and stuff to kind of like mitigate some of those.
Yep.
Let's start out with kind of what I see as like the number one stopper, like broad topic, and that is intense caregiving, right? I think that's the number one reason that our sex life is impacted. The caregiving that most other parents will never experience in their lives. A lot of our children require caregiving 24/7, so around the clock caregiving, which can be really difficult if you are constantly on high alert for the needs of your child, even throughout the night. Where a lot of parents are like, okay, my child's tucked in bed, you know, there's a chance they'll get up and be like, I peed my bed, or like whatever, like, you know, typical parenting stuff, but nothing compared to like the medical alarms going off. Something's wrong with the pulse ox. Like, are they still breathing? Like, I mean, this is very high alert mode that a lot of parents continue to be on during the night, which also includes opportunities for sex.
And obviously, in order to have a fulfilling sexual experience, we have to be relaxed. We have to be in the moment. We have to be able to like really let our guard down and just be present. And when we're afraid of an emergency happening one room over, there's no way that we can get our bodies to that point of physical relaxation. So we're on that high alert. Sex is the last thing on our mind oftentimes.
Yeah. Like this one parent said, nothing ruins the mood faster than a medical alarm. Mm-hmm. I think that could go on a t-shirt, but like, I think that right there really sums it up. And you said like, oh, an emergency the next room over. But another huge part of this that a lot of parents were talking about is a lack of privacy because their child is still rooming in with them at a much older age than like most kids would if they're rooming in. So, I mean, it's not even necessarily physically separated. It's like they're in the room with you. You're in the room with the monitors trying to get in the mood.
Or when it's like, actually, partners aren't even sleeping in the same room, right? Like, they're actually having to sleep in separate rooms because that's what works for everybody to get sleep. Like this quote here, we don't sleep in the same room. Our son has epilepsy and is cognitively 16 months old, so we co-sleep. The basic intimacy or connection is not there because of that, which of course I have so much compassion on her because I know a lot of parents are in the situation where we're just trying to survive, right? Like, maybe I sleep with my kid, you sleep there, we take turns so that we can each try and get a good night's sleep every few nights. Yeah, there's no sex happening at that situation, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's like so difficult. I do want to read too this other parent that they were in separate rooms or have been in separate rooms, but they still make it happen, which I thought was super cool. So she said, it has taken us being very intentional. I had to sleep with our daughter for years in a separate room than her spouse. And I had to make it intentional about going to be with him once I could sneak away for a little. We had to have open conversations and keep following up. And we had code texts to let the other one know where we were that night as far as taking time for intimacy. Sex helps keep our marriage much more alive, and so we do make it a priority. So obviously not ideal and not what we pictured when we got married or chose to be with this person. We didn't picture having to sneak off out of our separate bedrooms to like get in some sex. But like, you know, if that's what it takes, like, it sounds like that's obviously worth it. And I love that she says that it keeps her marriage much more alive. And so they make it a priority. That's kind of what it comes down to for them. And so I think that's very cool.
And one thing I love about that, and we'll talk about this a little bit more too, but Esther Perel, who's a like sex guru therapist, she's amazing. And in the show notes, we can put some of the books that she's written as well. But something that she talks a lot about is kind of keeping the mystery alive in your marriage and how desire is so important, right? We all know, like, if you've been in a long-term relationship, like, sex can get really monotonous. It can become the same. And something that just in all relationships keeps the spark going is mixing things up a little bit. And the thing I love about this quote is that there is something kind of fun and kind of like naughty about sneaking off. You know, you're texting your partner and you're like, are you in the mood? And they're like, yeah, are you? Yeah. You know, you can see how that could get fun quick. And then, you know, you're tiptoeing into a different room and then you go back to your separate rooms. I mean, there's something about that, even though, yeah, that's not how we envision it. And I'm sure that there's grief involved in that. There's also something really fun and playful about it.
Yeah, it's like pretty steamy. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I was like, I don't want to like put that on or just like minimize how that's like not what she pictured. I'm like, hot dang. Right. Like that is, it's like in like romance movies or whatever. They're like sneaking off into the other like hotel room or whatever.
Yep.
I mean, yeah, you can think of it that way.
I think that's really cool. That's like such, to me, that feels really resilient. It's like a real survival skill that they've been able to do that. And it makes sex a priority. It's like, no, we're going to do this at all costs, even if it means sneaking off into a separate room late at night. I think that's so great.
And like how desirable that probably makes them both feel to both be like, wow, yeah, like he prioritizes it. Yeah, like I prioritize, you know what I mean? Like kind of like we're both desirable and we want to be together. And I think even the way it happens in a different way than you pictured or other couples do, I think that's even kind of bonding, you know, emotionally too. Like, oh, look at us. We're so kinky. Look, we just can't keep our hands off each other. And, you know, I don't know. I think it's sweet.
Yeah. I love it.
Okay. So that's an idea, putting that out there. Be like this couple who I, again, have no idea who this was. So, you know, no need to be worried. I'm going to rat you out. And then another one too, within like this lack of privacy issue is the difficulty of going away like for a weekend or something. You know, if you're like, hey, like we, our child rooms in with us and this is like so not sexy and we don't have privacy. And, you know, your friends may be like, well, like go off then, like go to a hotel or something. And then for them to be like, oh, I can't, like I haven't been able to in years. This one person said, we haven't had a night away from my daughter in 7 years. And then another one said, too, she said, I find it hard to be in the mood. We rarely get time together. So it seems to intensify that it should happen, like if we're going off. And I even had this thought, like, we went to like this weekend conference for parents of kids that are deafblind, because we live in like one of the best states for deafblindness. Apparently they like have great resources and they put us in this hotel and they feed us great food. I even got to speak at it. And like, that night I was thinking, I was like, yeah, like I think this feels like for all these parents, we're like, this is the one time a year they get away. I was like, is this feeling pretty awkward? Is this feeling pretty forced? Like, okay, honey, like, I don't know, like kind of the opposite of the one we just read where it's like the spontaneous, like, hey, let's sneak off together. Right. Like, I think it could feel forced. And then that kind of kills the mood.
Especially if you haven't done it in a long time and you're like, well, okay, so now we're just going to go from 0 to 60 tonight. And, you know, we haven't touched or kissed in months. And now tonight we're like, cause you know, not everybody works that way. Not everybody's able to just jump in like that. So
yeah,
having that one night a year or something where suddenly you have time to do it, pressure's on, right?
And then another thing, obviously with the lack of privacy too, is those people who are lucky enough to have night nursing. How weird is it to try to like have sex while you have a nurse right down the hall? Like that's like really tricky. And then you might also have day nursing, and so you're like, we're never alone in our house. What if they like hear us and like report us? Or like, I don't know, I've heard like people be afraid of that kind of thing.
That's huge. Or, you know, I know there was quite a few years for us where we just had people in and out, a PT, an OT, a speech therapist. You know, there was never a time where we were alone. There's so many people in and out of the house. Yeah, I completely get that.
Yeah. And then there's also like the aspect of our sexual intimacy being very impacted and directly correlated to like how well our child is doing or not doing health-wise, like where they're like, oh yeah, like if my child's doing worse, our sex life goes down the drain. When they're doing better, it goes back up. And so there were a few people that were also talking about this awkwardness that you talk about happening once things were able to pick up again and like, okay, my child's doing well. Like, okay, well, like this feels really awkward. Like we're not just kind of like starting off where we left off. It's like, we don't feel that connection we used to and things feel weird now. And now we have to kind of like start all the way over again in like creating that sexual intimacy and familiarity. And I think that's hard. That's really hard.
Oh yeah. And there's so much that goes into that too. Like in a lot of the work that I do with clients, I do a lot of grief work. And there's this sort of like parallel process with grief where it's like, if somebody's parent died, they might feel guilty having sex because they're like, it's not right that I'm feeling pleasure and happiness when my dad just died. I think that similar sentiments can be kind of crossover in disability parenting where it's like, okay, my child just had a seizure and is in the hospital or, you know, something along those lines. My kid just had to have a surgery or something. And now like, here I am having sex. It doesn't feel right to be feeling pleasure and happiness while I feel like my child is suffering. So there's all this like emotional stuff that goes into it too, of us feeling like maybe we don't deserve it or it's wrong to feel pleasure while our child is suffering.
Yeah. I think it was like 2 years ago. This like seared in my memory. Someone was asking me, a listener was like, hey, do you have an episode about sex? And I was like, whoa, I hadn't really thought of that at that point. And she was like, because like, again, I have no idea who said this, but she was like, my husband and I don't have sex anymore because I feel so guilty experiencing pleasure while he's in pain. Like he's just constantly suffering. So how dare I go and like, especially something like sex, right? That's like the epitome of like pleasure.
Right.
And so while your child is in pain, like she felt so guilty about that. And I think I'm curious like how many people, I mean, that's a very personal thing and even probably one of those subconscious things, right? Like I wonder if anyone's listening right now, like, ah, that is that feeling I have of guilt when we're having sex. Like I didn't even realize that was why, but that's totally why. Mm-hmm. That I feel so guilty for experiencing this.
Yeah. Sex is so, obviously you don't need a therapist to say this, but sex is so emotional and really can connect to this deep emotional part of us that just feels completely shut down when we're at a heightened sense of stress and anxiety and all these emotions that we feel.
Yeah. This one parent was saying the inability to shake the heaviness that comes with grief, the hard decisions, the trauma, especially the early years of disability parenting. It's changed us and we carry layers of grief and historic and ongoing trauma in a way that we just can't shake off for date night. My husband and I are deeply bonded in that heaviness and this can be powerful and important and hold you together when things are hard. But it also means it's hard to snap into being lighthearted or playful, setting a mood for sex. I know that I'm good at being a disability mom. I'm very efficient. I'm patient. I know that being her parent is one of my real strengths. But I also think that it makes me less sexy, that it's hard to unsee the version of me fighting for her therapies, dealing with her feeds, crying at the hospital. I am many things, but I am not mysterious. Our life is special, but it is not spontaneous. And I think that this weight has changed desire for us.
That's so good. I mean, yeah. I mean, like profound and right. We have to function on a routine. So many of us, I know I do, in order for Asher to thrive, we have to be on a routine. He has to eat by 5:30. He has to go to bed at this time. This, everything's on a routine. Like there's not a lot of time for spontaneity and fun and silliness and playfulness. So.
Mm-hmm. And like she mentioned too, even just like, so there's that, like the practical real life stuff, but also like the emotional aspect of all that, of the grief and the historic trauma and the ongoing trauma and the difficult decisions that we're making and the hospitalizations and stuff, like to switch over into sex mode. And here's a thought that I had when I was reading this. I was like, okay, I can totally see where she's coming from. I think this is probably one of those things that people are like, oh yeah, me too. One thing that, you know, for me and how this relates to like us, like I feel like when I, not all the time, but sometimes when I'm feeling like so low, like things are just so dark and I feel so sad and, you know, all those things, I guess I don't think of sex as always lighthearted and playful.
Mm.
I've experienced like angsty sex, right? You're just like so distraught and you're both distraught. Mm. And like, this is how you're coming together in almost like this cathartic way of like, this is awful. I don't know. That was an interesting thing to me because I was like, I can see how you're just like, I'm just not in the mood. I don't want to be all playful and stuff. But I'm like, maybe sex for parents like us can be like looked at in a different perspective of like, maybe it's not the playful sex all the time. Maybe it's the angsty sex and like the comforting sex. And like, it's just a different emotional experience. And it fits that life a little bit more than just being like, oh my gosh, our child, I'm so afraid they're going to pass away. Like, we've been in the hospital all day. What are we going to do? Like, oh, hey, honey, like, let's get going. Like, it's just not going to be like that same type of sex that other people are having or that we see portrayed in media, like that, you know, what we think it should be.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I was thinking about, I've had three kids and Asher was our first kid. And I just have this like distinctive memory of when he was in the NICU, I was like, I mean, 3 weeks postpartum. And I remember being like, I want to have sex with my husband because it felt so connecting. And it felt like it's exactly what you're saying. It wasn't this like playful, fun sex. It was more like I need to be connected to my partner, the person that I'm going through this with. And I can say that with my other two kids who had a much more normative birthing experience, that was not my feeling. I did not feel like connecting to my husband that way after that. But there was something about that like really emotional experience. It was that it was a different kind of intimacy. It wasn't playful. It wasn't silly. It felt serious and maybe a little more, I don't know how to explain it, but I think you've got it where it's like, maybe it's important as partners for us to look at with your partner, what does sex actually look like for you? Maybe this is actually the opportunity to like change the script around it. Maybe you normally do have playful, fun sex that's like silly and flirtatious. And maybe that just means, okay, as a couple, that's not working for me, but I still want to connect to you in that way. So can we try to change the vibe a little bit, change the mood? Like, you know, it's a big question mark to me what that looks like for each couple, but I think it would start with a discussion about what does sex normally look like for us versus like, where am I right now with what I'm feeling and the emotions that I'm bringing in and how do we incorporate that into our sex life?
Yeah. And I think like disability parenting, you know, it puts its fingers in every aspect of our lives. And that's kind of the point of like all the different topics we cover on the podcast and why we're doing this topic. And I think making sure that like, there are some things that kind of get rewritten or rebuilt after you have a child with a disability. And I think your sex life, like if it still feels like you're trying to force it to be the way it used to be, like that's probably going to be really frustrating and just kind of fall flat. It is important to look at it and be like, I've rebuilt my life in a lot of ways. My friendships look different than they used to. The way I parent looks completely different than it used to. Am I still trying to force my sex life to look the same as it was before when it's just not going to? And I think leaning into that and like looking at how we do this or like what it looks like for us could make it feel so much more compatible with your life now and therefore increase the frequency and how rewarding it is and all those things would follow.
Yeah, definitely. That's an interesting thought. I'd love to hear from any listeners about if they've experienced that, if that resonates with them. I'm just so curious.
Yeah, me too. There's also like the fact that like so many parents are really in this emotional turmoil. And we've like alluded to this too, like the grief and everything, but like just kind of being in like this survival mode. This one mom was like, there's no room for intimacy. It's survival only. And that's in a very real way for a lot of families too, where it's like, I'm literally keeping my child alive all day. And so to switch over from that into something like sex, which feels so, I think we see as we all are like, oh, yes, like, you know, it's good for us emotionally or we need it. But like, it's not needed in the same way that like our child's suctioning is, you know, or things like that, that like they really truly need to be alive. And so I think that's hard to switch over to.
It feels unnecessary. It feels extra. It's like, I can't handle another thing on my to-do list.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of this message from this dad. I wanted to include some dads in here because we so often get moms. He said, the hardest part was feeling like sex became another thing on her to-do list. I wish I didn't need intimacy and I wish it didn't feel like a chore. I'm going to pause it really quick and just be like, ouch. Like I feel that the pain that this dad is experiencing. I wish I didn't need it. And I wish it didn't feel like a chore. Like, I think there's just so much pain there, like emotional pain, right? Like, it's not like this, like, oh, these animals that need, like, I don't know. Like, it's such an emotional thing.
Also, I would say to that dad, we all need intimacy. We do. It is a fundamental human need of ours. And that doesn't necessarily mean sex, although for some people, that is how intimacy is met. Clearly for this dad, that's one of the ways that he feels intimate with his partner. But I mean, just to kind of, I just wish that I could like look that guy in the eye, you know, and be like, we actually all need intimacy. It's a basic human need. And it makes me feel sad for him to be like, I wish I didn't need it. We all need it. It just looks different for some of us, you know?
Yeah. What are some ways that that would look? Other versions. You said sex is one version. What are some other versions that could look like?
It could look like connecting through a conversation. It could look like snuggling. It could look like someone to disclose secrets to, or someone to kind of tell your dark thoughts to. Intimacy could look like sitting at your child's bedside in the hospital. Intimacy is kind of like what connects us with our partner, those kind of like deep, tender moments that connect us with our partner that fill our gas tank. That's how I usually work. Feeling an intimate connection with your partner kind of fills your gas tank. And for some people, they're just wired for it to be like, no, sex does that. I feel most intimate with my partner when we're having sex or when we've been having sex. For other people, it's like, no, it's not sex. It's more like having good conversation, going out on a date, making eye contact, different things like that. So intimacy can be met in so many different ways. Today we're talking about sex. And I think stereotypically, although I would say that this is like not 100% true, not even close to 100% true, we say, oh, men need it through sex. Again, that's not true. That's like kind of, I think, an old wives' tale or whatever. But in this case, this is a dad who's saying like, no, sex is how I feel that intimacy is met.
Yeah. As you were listing off of those different ways that we can experience intimacy with our spouse that's not sex, I was like, I mean, all of these things that you said, I'm like, if Justin were doing that with another woman, I would not be okay with that.
Definitely.
And I think that shows that's like, so obviously this is very intimate, right? That's like something that is special for a partnership. And obviously, I mean, there are going to be different types of people that are like, oh no, like I'm okay with that. But I think for the most part, if you're like, if it's something that I would feel uncomfortable with him or her, you know, vice versa, whatever, doing with another person of the opposite gender or the gender they're attracted to, and I would be really jealous, like that's a sign that really, that's a very intimate thing. Yeah, like, and I think sometimes we don't think of it as that way. Like, oh no, it's just chatting with my wife or my husband. Right. And like, yeah, but if someone else were talking to this person that way, like I would,
yeah,
I would not be okay with that.
Right.
So
that's right. That's a good way to gauge it, right?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go back to what he was saying. I'll just start over from the beginning again. The hardest part was feeling like sex became another thing on her to-do list. I wish I didn't need intimacy and I wish it didn't feel like a chore. I work hard all day at a physically demanding job, so when things finally settle down and we get alone time, I'm exhausted. And I would wager she probably is too, right? That's another thing we heard from a lot of people. It's like, I'm exhausted by the end of the day. So if they both are, that's even exasperated. That leaves the weekends, but the days are packed with our child's back-to-back needs. So we might get 10 to 20 minutes mid-morning to fit it in. Before our child was born, we had a lot of time, and now we have no spontaneity. I think a lot of guys are afraid to say they need sex, both physically and emotionally. So there's that discrepancy. And again, like you said, I think that can go either way. There were some couples that also said, you know, neither of us want to have sex.
Yeah.
A lot of times you're going to be on a little bit of a different page. Like one of you is going to need it more or want it more than the other person. And that's really difficult. There can be discrepancies in that. And that's hard because I think it's also can feel like rejection on the one end if your partner doesn't want to, but you do.
Mm-hmm.
Or on the flip side of that, it can feel like nagging and like one more thing that is asked of you that you just don't want to do. And you've been doing things all day for other people. You know, so I think like it can feel really, again, it's a very emotional thing.
Mm-hmm. And just feels like another demand, right? Which is basically what this person is saying. Like, mm-hmm. Exhausted at the end of the day, like no energy for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's also one reason that people said that their sex life was impacted negatively was the fear of becoming pregnant. So this is one that kind of stems back to the episode we did about family planning, episode 99. That's a big one because, you know, the topic of family planning is a really big one and a very loaded one and one that people have very complex feelings, lots of grief around and stress. And a lot of times the partner doesn't necessarily agree with what you feel you want to do with growing your family or not growing your family. And so I think it makes sense that it would also leach into your sex life because obviously that's how most babies are made. So,
yeah, I would say in that situation, I mean, that may be the time to think about like a vasectomy or maybe the person's like, we're not quite ready to like completely, you know, say we're not having any more kids at that point. But, you know, I would encourage that person to like then think about what, or not even a vasectomy, but maybe just like birth control or condoms or something. But like, maybe even that doesn't feel like enough. Just there's just this huge fear of getting pregnant. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's probably what it is, like using birth control one way or another. but then still feeling like, but there's always that, you know, yeah. the percentage chance. And like, especially within this population, we all have issues when we hear like, it's not that likely, it's this percent. Exactly. You're like, okay, but like, that's where I land. Like, my child has this incredibly rare condition that like, one a million. And so if you're telling me it's not that likely you'll get pregnant while using a condom, you're like, okay, yeah, but like, maybe for you, but I'll be the one who gets pregnant. And
right.
So I think that we all have trust issues with statistics now because of where our kids land. And so I think, you know, that can impact that. I think also, like, this is just going a little deeper, but like, when there's trauma around, especially if you're disabled or medically complex child was the last pregnancy you had, right? I think there can be a lot of trauma related to pregnancy in general. And especially if you found out that your child would have these issues while you were still pregnant with them. And so I think that that can also be kind of an emotional blocker that you may have subconsciously of like the trauma kind of leaked into like even just the sex, because you're like, this is how we conceived Kimball and then look what happened afterwards. And, you know, I don't know. I think that that can absolutely impact it as well.
Definitely. I mean, sex is for most of us, unless it was conceived with like medical intervention, like, yeah, like sex is how a lot of our babies were conceived. And so there's definitely that connection there that it's like, I don't want to have to go through that again.
Mm-hmm. That association. And then another one, another hurdle that a lot of parents face is kind of this disconnect in real life. So outside the bedroom, like, you know, just in everyday life, if you're not feeling connected or you feel resentment, a lot of parents are feeling resentment towards there being an unequal caregiver load, which sometimes is by necessity, but is still really hard, or like they don't feel like they contribute when they should. Actually, let me read what this person said. She said, my gut reaction now most of the time is to say no, stop, and get annoyed. It all comes from resentment. Me being the preferred parent, me being the one literally doing everything medical, I shouldn't have to constantly ask him to be involved with her cares or know her schedule. I just wish it didn't fall on me. And so I think that absolutely is going to impact your sex life.
Especially if your partner is sitting there being like, want to have sex. And you're like, don't ask me to do another thing.
Yeah.
But to this couple, actually, have you ever done an episode on the mental load?
No, I've thought about it.
That's what she's talking about, right? Is just the absolute exhaustion of the mental load, you know, making appointments, reordering.
It all falls on her. Yeah.
Communicating with the teachers. And then to feel like, oh, you want to have sex? Like, yeah, that is instant resentment. But to this couple, I would say that is a problem that can be worked on. There's a lot of things that that couple can do to try and even out the mental load. And my guess is like, if he would just step up in certain areas so that she feels like she can gain a little more energy, right? Like all of her energy is being spent on caretaking. So there's no energy then to meet his needs too, right? So if he could just step in and actually start to take some of this over, which requires her to trust him, right? Like, I'm trusting that you're going to make the appointment the right way. I'm trusting that you're going to X, Y, Z, you know, the right way. That's kind of her role in that, right? Is that she's probably micromanaging in a lot of ways. And my guess is if he could step up over time, over the course of 6 months or so, learn how to do some of this stuff, that actually might like balance the equity in their relationship and make it so maybe there is a little more energy to have sex, have fun together. Like, but right now, that resentment is too high. There's no way.
Yeah. Like you say, like it goes beyond like even just the energy gained by like, oh, no, I'm not spending this energy. But it's also like just that resentment towards someone of like, you don't have my back.
Yes.
I feel betrayed by you. You make me do all of it. You don't even care until it's time to like have sex. I think that can, again, like we keep saying over and over again, it's a very emotional thing.
Right.
It's more than just like the physical aspect of sex. And so I think like feeling cared for in a loving way and like he cares about me will make you a lot more like, and now I want to go have sex because he cares about me, you know?
I like it that we did sex and then we're like, oh yeah, mental load. It's all connected.
Mental load. It is. Okay. Can we talk really quick too about a big one? And that is like being in like fight or flight mode, anxiety, high levels of adrenaline, and then feeling like you can be in the emotional spot to have sex. I know we've kind of like danced around that, but there were a lot of parents that were like, I am so anxious.
Yeah.
Or like, I'm so triggered all the time. I just can't be intimate. So someone said specifically, how do you get emotionally amped up when you're emotionally drained all the freaking time? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like as a therapist, like what would you suggest to these people?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that like sex is actually another form of getting amped up. If you think about it also, like, you know, your adrenaline's probably going then, you're in a heightened state. So it's not exactly like
on to off or off to on.
Yeah, right. Like, like you need to be relaxed to be able to kind of engage in sex. But during the act of sex, your body's being kind of brought back up to like an intense state then too. So your body just straight up may not be craving that because it's like, I'm constantly on edge, right? I don't want to get back to that point in some ways, even though it's a different motivator. But I mean, I think in that situation, it really starts with individual work around like calming her nervous system. Like really, I'm not saying sex shouldn't be on the table because it definitely should be if she wants it. But in order to really engage in like fulfilling sex, you do have to be able to have your mind in the present moment. You have to be able to calm your body enough so that you're able to like feel pleasure and like enjoy it in the moment. And so I would just encourage that person to like really start to work on some grounding skills and start to unpack that anxiety, whether it's with a therapist, whether maybe she's considering medication, EMDR, like, you know, what does her support around her anxiety look like so that she can, I mean, apart from sex, even like, what can she do to try and start to like bring herself back to her present moment, work on that anxiety, face some of the trauma that she probably has too. And then, you know, I think over time, the door will open up where maybe she'll feel like she can put her guard down enough to have sex. But right now, like, yeah, if you're worried that your kid is going to have a seizure one room over in the same room, or you're worried that your kid's going to die or something, like most people aren't wanting to have sex at that point. So.
Mm-hmm. And you have to feel safe. I think that's what it comes down to.
You have to feel safe. Exactly. Right. And so many of us are in, like she's saying, that state of fight or flight. That's not safety. Right.
Mm-hmm. Here's the paradox of it is that you're too stressed to have sex. And yet sex is one of the ways to complete the stress cycle. Yes. Right. And so it's like, I'm too stressed to have sex. And yet if I go have sex, I'll feel like this huge stress reliever and this high afterward, and probably will feel a little more relaxed and more unified. And it will actually, because that's what a few parents were saying too, is like, a lot of times I don't feel like it, but I do it anyway. And then I'm always glad I did afterwards. Yep. And so I think if you see it that way too, of like, yes, I feel so stressed out, you probably need to do some other things too, like kind of bridge that gap a bit more. But then like, if I can get myself to that point and have the sex, then I will actually feel a bit better.
Yeah, definitely. And you'll oftentimes feel closer to your partner too. So it's like a double win.
Mm-hmm. Like it could be what you need. It's just like, and that's probably what a lot of people know. Like, of course, like, I know that's what I need. I need sex, but I'm just not in the mood. I don't know how to get to that point. And so finding a way to bridge that over, I think, you know, is worth the work.
Yeah. And one thing that I often suggest to couples is it's coming from an exercise called Sensate Focus, which we often give to couples where maybe sex is painful or, you know, they just have some bad associations with sex. Sensate Focus is this exercise where you just start with like non-sexual touch. Like if you feel like we haven't had sex in a really long time, or I'm not sure if I want to have sex. I mean, you can Google Sensate Focus and find like an actual script to it online, but literally like set the timer on your phone for maybe 5 minutes and you just take like, so I would go first touching my partner and maybe just do like 5 minutes of non-sexual touch. So maybe you're rubbing shoulders, touching their scalp, all sorts of things like that. And then you switch, then your partner has 5 minutes of touching you that way. Over time, you start to increase maybe the time, and maybe eventually it's leading to like more sexual touch when you feel safe to do so. But this is a really good way to like reintroduce yourself to touching your partner in a way that feels safe. And it's kind of like exploratory too. You're like, ooh, that kind of felt good. Or I love it when you like touch my arm lightly or something. You know, you're relearning what you like in a really safe, controlled environment. And really, I mean, especially in the beginning part, but throughout the entire thing, there's no expectation of having sex. Like, in fact, in the beginning point of it, you shouldn't have sex. It's like, you know, you want to stop before it gets to that point so that it takes the pressure off. So that's a really great exercise to do if you're like, we haven't had sex in forever. I don't even know if I want to have sex, you know, just to like increase that intimacy a little bit.
Yeah, I really like that. That sounds like a really great way to bridge it around. Just like, you haven't had sex in years. Yeah. Now go to town, like You know, that's just not super realistic. Right. Going along with that too, a lot of parents also feel this lack of confidence, like their self-confidence has taken a hit since their disabled child was born. See also the episode we did about health issues and things that come up. One of those was like people either losing a ton of weight or gaining a ton of weight and then, you know, not feeling like themselves or not feeling like attractive. Obviously, that's going to also impact, you know, if you're like, I feel so frumpy. I don't feel attractive at all.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be in the mood to like go like have sex with my spouse.
Yeah.
So this one parent was saying stress and lack of sleep led to major weight gain for me. While my husband says he's still attracted to me, it's not the same. My lack of confidence shows up in the bedroom for sure.
I think also we had the episode on like talking about the way that it's like our bodies hurt. Also, you know, you're lifting a heavy kid or carrying all this equipment around. Like, yeah, like we're just, sometimes our bodies are not in the best point to be having sex, whether it's you don't feel good about your body or you're in pain or whatever else.
Yeah, that's really tricky too. That's really hard. So Amanda, what tips do you have? Like, I know you've given some other advice. What are our last few tips to leave parents with? You know, we've talked a lot about the issues. What are some things that we can do to improve our sex lives if that's something we are prioritizing or want to prioritize?
So it's a big question, and I think there's multiple ways that we can go about doing this. But one thing I just want to say is, and I sort of talked about this earlier, but like so much of disability parenting like takes away like the mystery and desire of sex. And for a lot of us, it's like, how do we get that back, right? Like maybe your child is like 9 and they wear a diaper and you're like changing the diaper. It's like, all these things that we're doing that we never envisioned doing, they're just not sexy. It doesn't put us in a good mindset of having sex. And so the question is like, how can we kind of like re-evoke some of that mystery and like sexiness in our relationship? And to get back to Esther Perel again, one thing that she asks each of us to have the answer to is, when am I most drawn to my partner? And these sort of 4 answers that she's found to it universally. Number 1, when I see them in their element. So this gives us a glimpse of what it looks like when our partner doesn't need us, how they behave when they're engaged in self-reliance. And there's something really sexy about that when we're allowed to let go of our caretaking impulse and just bask in their shine, right? So when you see your partner doing something that they love or that they're good at, that feels really sexy. That feels really attractive. The second thing, when we've reunited after being apart. So I think about this couple that we talked about earlier that, you know, they're sleeping in separate rooms. There's something kind of sexy about that, right? Because they can text each other and then they are meeting in the hallway and they're like, oh my gosh, I missed you, right? So we know that desire is rooted in absence and longing, and the experience of not having each other really increases our want for each other. And so if our partner's in front of us all the time, it's really easy to kind of take them for granted. So when they're gone, it's actually nice to miss them. So I don't know what that would look like for most of us, but just remembering that distance in some ways really does make the heart grow fonder. The next point that she says is, when my partner surprises me, I'm really drawn to them. And this can mean a million different things. This could mean, oh, you surprised me with flowers, or I wasn't expecting you to do X, Y, Z. You surprised me. Again, that kind of incorporates that element of mystery, right? It just mixes things up. Like when we do the same thing every day over and over and over, it can get really boring. And so when your partner surprises you, literally does anything out of the ordinary, that leaves room for a little bit of attraction there. And then the last thing that she says, when am I most drawn to my partner, is when I see them through the eyes of another. So scenarios that show us our partner through the eyes of another can remind us of what we used to see in them or the parts that we've maybe come to take for granted, right? So think about the early days in your relationship when everything was new, when you loved the way they dressed or the way they laughed or something. When we've been together for a long time, all of that kind of falls by the wayside. So being able to see your partner the way that other people sees them can be really attractive. When you see someone else react to your partner's humor or charm, that can make us feel validated and proud and even lucky to have them in our lives. So those are like 4 ways that you can think, okay, this is like universally some ways that we are really drawn to our partner. I wonder, can I like kind of replicate some of this in my life? Another tip that I would say, and this is like probably the most unsexy thing to do, but would be to schedule sex. You know, there's sort of this we feel like sex needs to be impromptu and spontaneous and, oh, wow, like how did, you know, like the olden days or something. But as I said earlier, like, no, we are in routine. Things happen on the clock and there's not a lot of time for spontaneity. So I encourage couples to like send a text or, you know, say, okay, Thursday, right? We're going to put the kids to bed and then we're going to have sex, right? Or let's get up early and do it then. The fun thing about scheduling sex is that you can sort of like flirt around it. Like you can say, okay, right, we're having sex on Saturday, right? And then, you know, play into it a little bit, you know? How can you like kind of, can you tease a little? Can you have fun with that? Can you send sexy texts? Can you get excited about it, right? Then that like gives you an opportunity to look forward to it.
Well, I think that's also like a really good chance to like give yourself longer to get in the mood. So it's not just like, oh my gosh, I just suctioned my kid for the umpteenth time today. And then like, oh, honey, you want to go have sex? And to be like, I can't just go, you know, straight from that to this. But if you're kind of anticipating it all day, your thoughts may wander and you might be watching him in a different way. You know, I think that is a really great way. I mean, like, I think scheduling sex for this population is a really big one that could help a lot.
And with shared calendars, put a little emoji, put a little eggplant emoji, you know, on the third calendar. Like there are so many fun ways that you can do this that can lead to flirting and sexiness. So I would just say play with that and give it a go. And then the last thing that I'll say that I think is really important for couples to have sex, this isn't exactly about sex, but John Gottman, who's a couples therapist in Seattle, he says to do what he calls the State of the Union address. So he suggests one night a week, you sit down with your partner and you just talk about the week. You talk about maybe what your schedule's like for the week. And you also do a brief check-in on like, what's going good for us this week? What do I need this week? And that could be a great point to be like, okay, so is there a time this week that we could have sex? Like what works for you? So the thing about the State of the Union, again, it's not incredibly sexy, but as disability parents, we're just not often connecting with our partner more than logistically, right, about what's going on. So the State of the Union really gives us an opportunity to check in. It's a very intentional conversation that you're having one night a week, the same time every, so it's like every Sunday at 9 p.m., let's meet at the dining room table with a glass of wine, half hour, just check in, what's going on for the week? What do you need? What do I need? What are we doing good? What's one thing? It's like almost like a little DIY therapy session. I will put one caveat on it and say, if you're a high conflict couple, just be careful with this one because it's really easy for it to escalate. So, you know, if you're a couple that fights really easily, just really set some guidelines about your State of the Union. Otherwise it can get out of control.
Or you could pick a time, like this time of day, I feel the least keyed up and like, you know, which I assume will be when the kids are not awake.
That's right. You don't want the kids for this. So yeah, I think those are kind of just some tips for how you can connect to each other and also how you can be more intentional about sex. But I also just want to highlight that this is not easy stuff, especially when we've had these patterns for years and years and we're all like really overwhelmed with stuff. So be gentle on yourself. And also I would just say like no marriage is unsalvageable. And if you want to start having sex in your relationship and it's been a while, don't give up and don't feel shame about it. Because as you can tell from the statistics we started the podcast with, like a lot of couples are in the same boat.
Yeah, I totally echo that. One thing really quick too, I wanted to add in with like the whole scheduling sex thing. I just follow someone who's a sex therapist on social media, and she was talking about one of the reasons she loves scheduling sex, and she doesn't have a disabled child. She has a baby. That's it. Like, you know, it's a different situation. But she was saying that when they schedule sex and they're like, okay, like we have a sex date tonight, you know, 8 o'clock, I'm so excited. Then it also can help impact helping you get into the mood, because she would say things like, you know what, I was going to make dinner, but I knew that if I made dinner, like I would feel really keyed up by the time you got home. I was just feeling overwhelmed. We're having sandwiches tonight. Can you take the kid while I go take a long hot shower? Yeah. So I can just like come down from the day. And I think that's another great way, because the getting yourself primed and ready to go can, and getting in the mood can last the day, but it also can like include your partner and be like, oh yeah, totally. Like, let me take the child. You go take the shower. Like, you deserve that. So I think that's also a really great way that plays into it as well. I just had to throw that in there.
Love it. That's good.
So on that note, Thank you so much, Amanda. I really, really appreciate it. And like you say, there's no shame in, you know, listening to this episode and be like, we have so far to go, so far we want to go. So many parents are in that boat and we're rooting you on. You got this.
Yeah, got it.
Another huge thank you to everyone who shared their thoughts on this topic and made this episode possible, as well as the lovely Amanda Griffith Atkins for joining me. Also, thanks a million to Alyssa Newtile, who handles so much of the post-production of each episode. I could not do it without you. And to our board of directors, including Brittany Stites, who does so much for the fundraising. So much of the podcast is owed to her, too. I am so lucky to have so many helping The Rare Life and its success. Linked in the show notes are the resources Amanda mentioned in the episode, a link to episode 99 about family planning, if you're interested in checking that one out, and a link to episode 99 about family planning, if you're interested in checking that one out. Also, side note that we are actually in the works of planning the division of caregiving load that we mentioned in this episode. It'll come out later this season. Stay tuned. Also in the show notes are links to follow Amanda and me on social media, where we will be sharing lots of details and hype on the upcoming fundraiser. Join us next week for an episode from the perspective of those closest to us, our parents, our siblings, our best friends. This episode is truly enlightening and heartwarming. Do not miss it. See you then.